There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM. We are broadcasting live. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Aya Bitson.
We wanted to say happy almost Halloween to everyone listening. Today, we broadcast live from the Jiuyage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:03.
Raph is a queer Latina. His play Salvador, a Latin-Canadian fantasia, won the Playwrights Guild of Canada's RBC Emerging Playwright Award. In 2017, his second play, Rope Running Out, premiered at Lemon Tree Creations to a 4N review from Now Magazine and 12 Broadway World Toronto nominations, including Best New Play. We talked to Raph about his journey with trauma, creating art as a therapeutic outlet, his aim to accurately portray queer youth of color in the LGBTQ+ community in Toronto. We wanted to issue a content warning. In our interview, Raph discusses trauma, homophobia, substance abuse, and sexual abuse. Before that, we have our weekly headlines and a few tunes. First up is The Not Real Lake by Loving, followed by Echo of Dawn by Tops. Enjoy.
This magic hour, all confused the power of a stolen world. For what is unheard? For what is unheard? But what is certain?
as I am forgetting, and that is a blessing. Angry weather in my head, angry weather in my head, angry weather in my head.
Was The Not Real Lake by Loving and Echo of Dawn by Tops. The time now is 5:10. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
A Quebecois couple has been ordered to pay their former landlords $18,000 after homophobic behavior, notably Facebook posts, verbal comments, and hand gestures that continued for over a year. The landlords, Renelle Blaise and Richard Alain Louer, accused the tenants of harassing them after a noise complaint got out of hand in their Quebec City area building. Blaise and Loubert were, quote, deeply affected, unquote, by this conflict, and considered selling the property to rid themselves of the problem. Quebec human rights judge Doris Thubault wrote, The landlord couple, who had been together for over 20 years, said the ordeal brought back traumatic memories of when they were harassed about their sexuality in their younger years. The tenants in question had lived in the building since 1995 and lived under Blaise and Loubert's control from 2015 onwards. After sending the tenants a letter saying they were to repossess the building in 2016, the homophobic behavior began. This behavior included verbal abuse, discriminatory gestures, and online postings. Judge Thubault found the tenant couple guilty, charging them $7,000 for the damages plus an additional $10,000.
A group of defense lawyers have intervened in the appeal of the status imposed on Quebec mosque shooter Alexandre Bissonnette. In January 2017, Bissonnette shot and killed six men after entering the prayer room of Quebec City's largest mosque. He pleaded guilty to 6 accounts of first-degree murder and 6 accounts of attempted murder, leaving him with 6 consecutive 25-year terms. The defense group will argue that the Criminal Code of Canada contradicts the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, saying that judges cannot impose consecutive life sentences exceeding life expectancy, as this would be, quote, inconsistent with human dignity, end quote. Both the Crown and the defense have appealed Bissonnette's sentence. The case is to be heard early next year, the Crown arguing for 50 years before Bissonnette's first parole attempt, the defense wanting the period reduced to 25 years.
The McGill University Health Center is appealing to the provincial government for extra funds to reopen more hospital beds, as they were concerned that some cancer patients are not undergoing surgery within the medically acceptable time limit of 4 weeks. The MUHC needs funding for at least 43 other beds, both post-operative and intensive care needed. In its last fiscal year, the MUHC reported 1,014 staff beds all on site. This is one of the many years that MHUC has fought with Quebec Health Ministry. In 2017, former Health Minister Gaétan Barrette refused to refinance MUHC above an occupancy rate of 85% when numbers regularly reached 90%. The director of MUHC's Professional Services Division has noted that relations have improved ever since the Coalition Avenir Quebec took power last year. Across Montreal, it is noted that 52% of oncology patients need surgeries within 4 weeks of being put on the waiting list. Despite the funding squeeze, the MUHC has slashed the number of patients waiting longer than a year for all types of surgery. 2 years ago, several hundred patients were waiting longer than a year for surgery. Today, it's down to a handful.
Today in Toronto, a protest is organized to begin at 6 p.m., taking place at the Toronto Public Library's Palmerston branch. Toronto Public Library has seen fit to allow Megan Murphy, a trans-exclusionary writer, banned from Twitter for hate speech, to hold a talk at its Palmerston branch this Tuesday at 6:45 p.m., despite clear language in TPL rental policy that gives the library the right to refuse events that will further endanger vulnerable people. Despite a petition with thousands of signatures demanding the event to be cancelled, a call from Toronto Mayor John Tory requesting the same, and many TPL staff members speaking out, City Librarian Vickery Bowles has not only refused to reconsider, but has gone so far as to represent transphobes as a marginalized group. Every trans-affirming member of the community is welcome to the peaceful protest held outside the Palmerston branch, located near the Bloor Street and Bathurst intersection. For more information on the protest, visit the Facebook page titled, quote, Support Trans People, Protest at Toronto Public Library, unquote.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Don't go anywhere. We have a great interview coming up. In the meantime, enjoy Munya with Troptard, followed by Escape by Ori.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:20. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was Munya with Trotard, followed by Uri with Escape.
Now for our interview with Raf Antonio. We spoke with Raf about his journey with trauma, creating as a therapeutic outlet, his aim to accurately portray queer youth of color and the LGBT community in Toronto. We want to issue a content warning. In our interview, Raf discusses trauma, homophobia, substance abuse, and sexual abuse. Please enjoy. Amy from CKUT.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Okay, so to begin, one of your main crafts is playwriting. How did you get involved with that medium?
So I was always involved in theater as a kid. I spent a lot of time, like, making up a lot of stories about myself, and I was really interested in just, like, creating little narratives. So eventually I went to school for musical theater, and while I was there, I kind of realized that there just weren't a lot of parts for people of color, especially queer people of color, and that was when I decided, like, oh, I'm probably a lot better off contributing to the canon as a writer, you know, and creating these parts for people, the kind of parts that I would have wanted to play as an actor, and so that was really how I got into it.
And what is unique about playwriting? In contrast with the other creative mediums you explore?
I think playwriting is really about creating the foundation for others to build upon. So there's a lot less control, and you're really required to let go more than you might with, for example, some of the filmmaking that I've done or the photo work that I've done. There's a lot more collaboration. I made a short, like my first short, a few years ago, I had a full crew, and that, you know, it still requires a lot of collaboration, but because I was also the director, like, ultimately, I had to shepherd the vision. And playwriting, unless you're directing it as well, requires like a lot of trust in the people that you're working with.
And so you won an award for your play titled Salvador. And I'm just wondering, what is the premise behind the play and what were some inspirations for the plot?
Yeah, so Salvador is about a writer who returns to the place he's from after 20 years, now as a fully out gay man, and he has to reconcile his relative freedom to be out in Canada versus the dangerous reality of being out in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
And so the inspiration for the plot was, I call Salvador a docudrama because it contains these snippets of a conversation I had with Joaquin Casares, who runs Asociación Entre Amigos with his partner, William Hernandez, and because it actually like really mirrors the experience I was having at that time. I had returned to El Salvador for the first time after like 20 years, and I kept thinking about what my life might have been like if my family had stayed there, and so I tried to find answers. But, you know, of course, the reality is I can never really know those answers. Even though I talked to a lot of members of the community, and that was, like, you know, I was doing these interviews, but, like, I'm always going to carry the bias of where I'm from. So that's really where the play kind of grew from, and because I also wanted to shine a light on what William and Joaquin were doing in El Salvador and the work they were doing.
So how does your work as a queer Latinx artist combat the machismo attitude that often occurs within Latin culture?
For me, it's about the fact that the characters I choose to center in the stories, often those characters would have been the side characters in other plots, you know, the brown femme queers.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe strongly that visibility is super important. Giving these characters like depth and rich lives will help combat any like stigmas or bias that people might have. And like, I want to clarify too that like that doesn't mean that the characters that I write are saints. Like they're not. I'm not trying to just turn them into these like, you know, perfect beings. They're really imperfect people, and they're grappling with these big questions about love and self. And that's usually a storyline that's given to, like, white men or queer narratives, traditionally mass-presenting cis white men. So it's, to me, really about centering those particular characters in the narrative.
And has this machismo expectation ever hindered you specifically?
Yeah, I think it has, like, really affected me deeply. I feel like it really bore, like, deeply into my core and made me believe that I wasn't enough somehow, you know, like, or I was bad somehow. So, like, and fighting against that is, like, super, super emotionally draining. But you do it because you know you have to live in your truth. And that fight, I think that like, constant fight that I was experiencing when I was younger, I think it centered me in a lot of ways. I didn't have, or I had to fight to find the energy to focus on my art and my creativity. So in that way, I'd say it was a detriment to my career and my mental health. I started relatively late because I was so focused on just like trying to live truthfully.
And how do you think young queer Latinx artists are working to redefine this concept of machismo?
I think, like it's so amazing now with, like, Instagram and access to the internet, like, the work that I'm seeing that's out there from young queer Latinx folk, like, is the kind of work that, like, I really, really needed as a kid. They're centering, like, femme and trans identities and, like, really questioning, like, the erasure of indigenous identities as well. And, like, there's this Instagram account called New Latinx, and I mean, it's just so, like, beautiful to see the very people that are featured on there. We're getting to see, like, this whole spectrum of the culture, and it's those artists and people, like, local people here in Toronto, like Augusto Bitter, like, who's a really good friend of mine, who they, like, give me really a lot of future, hope for the future of Latinx representation, because really digging into this idea of what a man is supposed to be or what a woman is supposed to be, I think is super important. And I think people just need to get on this train and give us bigger platforms to and positions of power so we can continue to lift others up as well.
Do you think there is a different struggle with gender neutral, I guess, identifiers when it comes to the Spanish language in comparison to the English language because of the grammar structure?
Yeah, I guess so. This question is kind of funny to me because, like, I don't really speak a lot of Spanish. I speak very conversational Spanish, and I'm not, like, super immersed in Latinx culture. Like, I don't spend a lot of time with other Latinx people, like, speaking Spanish. Because I was raised, with the way I was raised, like, I was raised to speak English to my parents, and then they would speak Spanish to me. So, but definitely, I would say, you know, with English, like, it's a lot easier to use gender-neutral language, I would say, despite what, like, the grammar police say.
Mm-hmm.
In Spanish, like, the gendering of language is so embedded in it, like, it gets a little complicated if you're gonna, like, add an X to everything, you know? Like,
yeah.
It just gets a little messy, so, and it always becomes, like, a parody of itself, so... I mean, yeah, there's definitely a weird sort of struggle that goes on there, but I admit I don't really have to deal with it that often because I don't really spend a lot of time speaking Spanish.
I want to discuss your other play, Rope Running Out, but would you first mind providing a little summary of the plot?
Sure. So Rope Running Out is about a queer couple who, due to past trauma, are living in a non-sexually physical relationship. Their lives are then turned upside down when a man comes in and challenges their perceptions, leading to a deeper connection between them.
So how did you approach portraying the theme of trauma, and how do you ensure it is both an ethical but also authentic portrayal?
So that one, again, it comes back to a need that I had, like, for myself in proper representation, like, too often I was seeing these narratives where trauma was used as, like, a shock tactic, often, like, ruining characters' lives or whatever. You know, it was always this, like, this really, like, horrible thing that was happening to people. And I myself am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and I had lived through relationships that might have failed because of the trauma, but they were still filled with, like, a lot of love and patience and care. And I just really wanted... I needed to see that side of love between people who have experienced this sort of thing, you know, and to put that out into the world. And I knew that if I needed it, then someone else did too.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't, like, define the trauma that the character Ignacio experiences in the script, in his past, but I put as much of myself into the script and my own experience while still keeping it fictional. That I knew would be authentic to a survivor's experience. Not every survivor, of course, but specificity often translates into a kind of universality. And I knew, too, that because I was writing something I needed, that I wasn't going to, like, go tip over the line and sensationalize the trauma for the sake of drama, you know? It was like, I knew the audience was in safe hands with me.
Mm-hmm.
And the actors were protected by working with an intimacy coach and being surrounded by queer artists and other people of color. Like, we did everything in our power to keep it really, just keep it a very safe environment.
So, as you mentioned, Rope Running Out has a cast of only three men. So how did this intimate setup of the cast contribute to the quality of the play itself?
Focusing the story on the three characters allows us to get, like, so much deeper with them, to get much closer into their psyches. And going back to what I said before, we don't often get intimate with, like, these intimate character studies with Latinx queer men, or often even just, like, brown and black men. And even though the show isn't making these, like, big political statements, that psychological depth for me and centering of brown and black intimacy is political in itself. So I think that that's how it really contributes to the quality.
So we've spoken a lot about your literary accomplishments. Now I wanted to focus on your visual work. You have a series titled Self-Portraits where you portray yourself in many different looks, both mask and femme. Would you mind explaining the meaning behind that series?
Yeah, so I was going through this, like, pretty rough patch for a while where, like, I wasn't able to see myself as beautiful, and being single at that time, I was struggling with, like, being rejected or fetishized so often because of my femme presentation and, you know, indigenous-leaning looks, and I was spending a lot of time on Tumblr where I saw all these younger queers, not just younger, but queers of all ages, like, really embracing themselves and being exactly who they wanted to be, like, society be damned. And that, like, super inspired me to take myself back in a way. So I wanted to see myself in all the facets I knew that I had within me and hopefully inspire somebody else to do the same. So it was about, in a way, like, exercising the box I felt I was placed in and redefining myself on my own terms. To see myself as glamorous or naturally beautiful was very healing for a time. But, you know, ultimately, I needed to learn to love the person I am on a daily basis. That person is much more boring than the person in the photos. So I'm a bit more both mask and femme, and integrating myself is a process that I but the photos definitely continue to still help with that process.
So the thematic element of intimacy is often the focus of your art. What is the reason for this?
I think because of the lack of acceptance I felt for being queer and the trauma in my past, I struggled with intimacy for a really long time. I still do sometimes, especially now with how digital everything has become. And I think in attempting to, like, define it for myself, it helps in the process of healing. Writing these themes and depicting these themes helps in that process. I can't, like, afford consistent therapy, so it helps to ease some of the pain, you know, and, like, and loneliness I often feel. Plus, again, in centering an Indigenous presenting Latinx femme queer in these intimate settings, hopefully it allows the people who view it to see my humanity and the humanity of others like me.
Going back to your writing, you've also published many essays. You mentioned substance abuse in Youth, Part 4, 2004 to 2005. How, going back to this idea of therapy, how is writing therapeutic for you?
This question is so funny because for a while, it goes in and out of being therapeutic for me, to be honest, because writing is such a, like, it's such a lonely thing a lot of the time, and you're putting so much, it costs so much of yourself to do it. But, like, for a long time, I was living this, like, cliche of, like, a boozed up writer, you know, hunched over my page. Because I had, like, really believed that it freed up my creativity, and I felt that it, like, legitimized my process. But as my career has grown and as I've worked to shape it, I've realized, like, how unsustainable it is to continue to do that, and that the hole that I was trying to fill, that, like, emptiness that was there, was going to be there whether I was drinking or not. I had to, like, do something about it, that because the substances, the drinking, the drugs, they were just bandages. They weren't doing anything to actually, like, stop that pain. So in some ways, writing has almost saved my life because I want to see the work pay off. I want to play the long game of my career, and I want to do it with a clear head and a clear heart. And, you know, I've been sober now for almost 9 months, and access to my muse without substance is, like, way more healing than it was before. But the reality is that it's still this, like, back and forth kind of game where it drains you and takes from you, and then you have to still, like, refill yourself in a healthier way, rather than, like, for me back in the day it was the booze and the drugs, and now it's not. So, you know, for me that's the healthier version.
So considering the vulnerability of your writing, would you consider your writing a form of advocacy or representation for queer youth struggling with their mental health?
I would say it is, to an extent. It's tough, though, because, like, you know, I don't really know how many people have access to my work, and so, even though I'm creating these characters and these narratives and being vulnerable through my art, like, it can feel quite a bit like I'm just, like, shouting into the void. Rope and Salvador both haven't been produced again, and they're not published, and, you know, my next play may not premiere for another couple of years, so even though I'm trying to uplift young queers, like, how many am I actually reaching? How much is actually possible? I struggle with that question a lot, so I have to focus on these, like, smaller accomplishments, the fact that I, you know, provide pay and work for queer and trans people of color through workshops, productions, and just hope people, you know, I just hope that maybe people will stumble across what I have to offer, and if they relate to it, maybe share it with others.
What do you think separates you from other artists and other works?
This is another question that I found really find really tough, because it's like I don't really know what separates me from other artists other than my, like, perspective. You know, I can only make the work from my particular little viewfinder. Right. So, I think, you know, you want to say these things like, oh, well, I have a really good work ethic, or, like, I have, you know, whatever. And, like, a lot of people have good work ethic. A lot of people have talent. It's just that particular viewpoint that you bring to your work that's so unique to you. You're the only person who can write the work the way that you write it. So I suppose that's what makes me different from other artists.
In light of Queer History Month, how is storytelling changing for the LGBTQ+ community?
Yeah, so what I love to see is, like, the vast array of narratives that are being created right now with, like, diverse people at the center. You know, we have a TV show like Vita, which is on Stars or on Crave in Canada, which is about, like, two Latinx sisters, one queer, whose mother's queer, and Pose with the largest trans cast on television, you know, that's, like, so amazing. So we're being allowed to see, like, deeper, more complicated portrayals of queer people than we had before. But it's not perfect, and, like, way more needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But considering what it used to be like, the kind of shows that were available when I was in my 20s, let's say, like, this feels almost like a whole different world. So it's really beautiful to see.
So you're based in Toronto. How do you think Toronto as a city supports the LGBTQ+ community?
Toronto is, I mean, it's such a complicated city. Mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, for all its claims of being so open and diverse, often the city really drops the ball in, like, true support. Mm-hmm. My work has been supported by the Toronto Arts Council, which is really, really helpful in some ways, obviously, but, like, what about affordable housing? Yeah. And then, you know, Toronto Pride is this huge and amazing event, but there's, like, all that mess about whether or not to let the police march, and it's, like, super commercial and capitalist, so I think a lot like the rest of society, there's this struggle to remain consistent when it comes to, like, basic human rights and dignity and living. So, you know, along with all that diversity that diversity of the city, there's what comes along with that is the fact that there are a lot of people who have also, like, drunk the Kool-Aid and would rather see, like, some idiot like Doug Ford in power than allow people to live, like, real equitable lives. And, and, you know, queer people of color are often the ones on the margins, so we're the ones who are often the most, like, affected by some of that inconsistency. And, I really love this city, but it needs to do better.
Have you collaborated with many artists and creators in the Toronto scene?
Yeah, I've been able to work with some really amazing theater people and a couple of film folk, but I really want to extend my reach and do more of that. I'm hoping to do more portraiture of queer folk in the future. But except, you know, like, I started working with Indra Kasapi and Marjorie Chan quite early in my career, and we got along so well that kind of just like, you're like, okay, we'll just like keep working together. So now we're like, you know, it's been several years of us working on stuff together. So, but I also don't want to get too insular and comfortable. So you kind of have to force yourself to meet other artists and, but I'm also quite shy, so that can be tough. You know, I'm always open to people reaching out and I'd like to work with more people, yeah.
What are your next steps as an artist?
So I've got a couple of things on the go. I'm working on two new plays. One, which is called White Muscle Daddy, which is a vampire allegory for colonialism and the effect of white supremacy on the brown and black, brown body and mind. And then The Effeminates, A Queer Tale of Bloody Vengeance, which, if all goes well, will premiere in 2022-23 season. I've also got a couple of film scripts on the stove, including possibly like two scripts for the second season of Miss Persona, which is an Emmy-nominated kids' web series and that my friend Kim Persona created. And then, you know, like I said, I want to do more portraiture, maybe a few more essays, and then my second short film, which hopefully we're going to shoot next summer.
And lastly, what is your advice to young queer artists looking to showcase their work?
Yeah, I would say, like, work hard, but remember to rest, because rest and recovery will really make the work better, and don't wait for people to give you permission to do your work. Do your research and find the people you want to work with, get in touch with them, ask for a meeting, apply for funding, apply for festivals, get your work in front of people, and if you fail at all of that, like, feel your feelings fully, then get back and do it again, because I think you're only going to get better by doing and experimenting and failing. Failing is part of the process, and art making is all process, so you have to embrace the fear and just, like, dive right in, because as I was saying before, you are equipped with this unique perspective that only you can bring to the work, so get out there.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Gone. Welcome back to Unfit to Print. Thanks for your insight, Raph. We hope you learned something new from that interview. Now we're going to take a quick music break. First up, we have Suez by Christian Sean, followed by Stay at Home Club by Andre. Don't go anywhere, because we will be right back.
You won't, I could stay for the summer. summer blue, leaving my body. You're so faith, leaving this place, and I saw a storm falling upon me like a love I couldn't afford. I saw my love leaving my body. You're so faith, leaving this place, and I saw a storm falling upon me like a love I couldn't afford. Put your guns up in the air tonight. We'll drink the water of the sky tonight. I don't wanna go to the club tonight. I wanna stay home and make love.
Get up in the morning with a need to leave. It's not me, cause I'm feeling fine. It's gotta be a problem with the world I'm in. I know it could be what I wanna be. And if I wanted, I could be a fucking god to preach. Guess I'm too hard to feel this low. Guess I'm too bad to feel my soul.
Thanks for tuning in this week. That was Christian Scene with Suze.
And Stay at Home Club by Andre. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Come back next week at the same time for another show. Once again, we want to thank Raph for speaking with us. To learn more about Raph's work, we'll be linking his page on our Twitter. After this show, search for Unfit to Print. We will see you all next week. Playing us out, we have Monster Mash, followed by the Symptoms of Love Stop Halloween mix. Have a spooky week.
I was working in the lab late one night. when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rack's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on and flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool, Rack's a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what is said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And you, my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
say stomp, 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 stomp. If I say stomp, 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 stomp.
Stop.